I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio. So yesterday, I struck out from my man cave and met up with a few of my friends at a local gastropub. After a few craft beers, my friend Will was dropping the F-bomb left and right, so before things got to a tipping point, we decided to get the heck out of there. We were all gassed, so we slammed down a few energy drinks and got on with our day. Now, that story's not true, but 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have even been able to tell you that story because seven of the words in that sentence were not actually words, but they are now, and that's thanks to Merriam-Webster, which has released the list of words it's adding to the Collegiate Dictionary for 2012. And if you've ever wondered who decides how new words get into the dictionary, your wondering days are over. With me now is Peter Sokolowski. He is a lexicographer and the editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster's. Peter, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So this is kind of something that comes around every year, and we get this big announcement of this list of new words that have made it into the dictionary. And we've got some cool ones this year that I want to get into, and we can talk a little bit about that. But first, tell me a little bit about the process, how it happens. Is it something that you guys decide once a year, or are you thinking about this all year long?
Oh, it's absolutely a year-round affair. Part of our jobs is to read, in fact. You know, we, as a team of editors who keep the dictionary up to date, about 40 of us, we spend a little part of each day, if we have the time, to read. And we all read something different. We make sure we coordinate that we're not reading the same things. We notice that way which words are being used, what are new words, what are, say, a new sense of an older existing word. And also maybe a change of part of speech, maybe a verb that used to be a noun, for example. We would notice all these kinds of things, and we mark them. We call it reading and marking. We mark it. We put it online on our database. It's added to our citation collection. And that way, at the end of a year or two or ten, we have a good sort of census of the language. We notice what's sort of moving in English that way. And it's a good way to start to make that process a continual sort of noticing, if you will, of which words are changing and moving in English. And then after a year or a decade, we make a new edition of the Collegiate roughly every decade. We can look back upon the year or the 10 years past and say which senses or words that were not included up to now deserve inclusion at this point.
Now, I notice you keep saying we. Who's the we?
Mm-hmm. We're just all editors. There's about 40 of us. If you have a Collegiate Dictionary in print, just open to the first page. It's a nice little masthead that's got all our names. And we have different specialties. It's a little bit like an academic faculty. So there's people with specialties, for example, in physical sciences, biological sciences, math, music, law, children's dictionaries, the etymology of words, the phonetic properties of words. You know, all the different specialties are represented. But for the most part, we all share the responsibility of writing dictionary definitions and noticing new words to define.
So interesting. Now, are you doing this in a particular place? I know that you guys are and have been historically based in Springfield, Massachusetts, so this is a homegrown thing for us. Do you have an office, or are you guys reading mm-hmm. off-site? Do you come in every day to an office? And does it, like, in my mind, it's like a library out of Harry Potter. There are a lot of people with beards, and you guys are, like, reading really old books.
All true. All true. yes, indeed. The Merriams were the printers. So if you're curious about the name, Noah Webster was the great Yankee lexicographer. His first dictionary was in 1806. And the printers, the printing shop in Springfield, Massachusetts, that was printing school books and Bibles and dictionaries, took over the publication of Webster's dictionary when he died. And they were in Springfield from 1831. They took over and published the first Springfield-based dictionary in 1847. So we go back a long way in Springfield. We moved to our current building in 1938, it is very much a quiet library-like environment. People don't really talk out loud on the editorial floor. That floor also, by the way, has the citation database, the files. We call them citations. You might call them quotations that are on 3x5 cards that go back, 120 years, they're all individually sort of, typed out or copied of the word, its context, its author, and its date. So we know exactly who wrote it and where it was published and when. And that is sort of the sort of archaeological work of lexicography. You go back in the files and you see when a word was used and how. Now, of course, we have online corpus databases. Corpora is the plural of corpus. We use these corpora and Google Books, for example, which is a newer technology that permits us to look back into many, many books without reading them.
That's fascinating. So how has, you know, how has the digital transformation changed what you do? Is it very different than it was 10 years ago? Is it completely different than it was 20 years ago? Or are there aspects of it that are exactly the same?
I would say that there are aspects that are the same in the sense that our job is to notice words and then report on them, if at the most basic level. And we did that on pen and paper. When I joined the company 18 years ago, the only computer on the editorial floor belonged to the editorial secretary, because it was more. When you think about how times have changed, it was more important for record keeping purposes for her to have a computer. None of the editors had one, and now it's unimaginable. All of our work, of course, it comes from the computer. Our last edition, the 11th edition of the Collegiate in 2003 was in fact edited and notated, marked up on paper. But our subsequent most recent dictionary, the dictionary made for non-native speakers of English that came out in 2008 called the Learner's Dictionary, which is a huge, massive project and a very interesting dictionary. That one was done entirely online. That is to say that we used sort of online or inter-office facsimiles of the old galley system, so that rather than stamping with colors, as we used to do, that would indicate sort of that this editor has seen and approved this page with all the changes made in ink or pencil. Now we make those changes in different colored markings on a computer screen, and then we pass it on to the next editor in that way. And so the fact is the process is faster, maybe a little easier to trace, in other ways resembles the old-fashioned methodical method, the methodical approach that we have employed for, you know, over 100 years. The other side of the internet for dictionaries, of course, is the business side. How has it changed the business of dictionaries? Yeah. So there's the creation of dictionaries, and then there's the business of dictionaries. And the business of dictionaries has obviously moved to a great extent online and on to other platforms like smartphones. And we find that the dictionary is not dead by any means. The prediction of the death of the print dictionary that we hear all the time has so far been a false one, and we still sell a lot of dictionaries in paperback and in hardcover. Not as many as before 2008, of course, but we also find that visits to our apps, the Merriam-Webster Collegiate app is a free one, by the way, and to our website at merriam-webster.com have increased. So in our estimation, people are using the dictionary more frequently because they have more and easier access to it.
And I think an interesting part of this is that it changes the relationship, it seems to me, a little bit about what your relationship is with the person who's accessing the dictionary. You're able to see what they're looking up online, and you're getting information about that, right?
So that is fascinating. You're absolutely right. In fact, I'm giving a lecture at the Modern Language Association conference, which I mention only because it takes place in Boston in January. And I'm giving a lecture on this. In fact, there's a panel on this subject, that is to say, how has the internet altered the way we use dictionaries? The best example I can think of is the one you just gave, which is the sort of Santa Claus rule. We now know what you're thinking.
Right.
whereas Noah Webster or Samuel Johnson in the old days, in the 19th century, 18th century, they could have spent a day or a week or a month on a given entry and never know which piece of it was consulted by the reader. Whereas we know to the moment which words are being looked up on our online dictionary, and it is a very valuable piece of information from both a linguistic and a cultural perspective. And what I mean by that is we have 100 million page views per month on this website, so it gives us a good sampling of what people are curious about. I can tell you that right as we speak, I'm looking at the page, and hooliganism is the most looked up word on our website right now. Well, you know why, I'm sure. The recent ruling in Russia about the group called Pussy Riot.
Right.
I had to think about the name there for a moment. And the term hooliganism was part of the legal description of their charges. And that's very often the kind of word that is looked up, a very specific technical term. The word when Michael Jackson died that was most looked up was emaciated, the condition, the reported condition of his body. And because there's a sort of technical edge to that term, even though we use it broadly to mean thin in some cases, there's also a medical definition, and that's why people consulted it. And so we see words that are looked up in that way for reasons of sort of triggers that are from the news. On the other hand, there are linguistic triggers that aren't that surprising. The two most looked up words in the English language day in and day out are affect and effect.
Of course, right. So people trying to distinguish which one between the two when they're deciding which one am I supposed to use here? Is it affect or is it effect?
Exactly. So people are, they're using it, they're working, they're writing.
Right. Do you have a sense of what the absolute most looked up word in the history since you've sort of been online? Is there one word that stands out that's been looked up more than any other? Do you know what that is?
That's a good question. You know, they go through. We have a on our homepage. We actually show the most popular terms in aggregate over the last day, week, and quarter. And those words tend to be words that are not triggered by the news.
Right.
In other words, they're words that are day in, day out, year in, year out, words that trigger curiosity. And we've found that overall, there's a handful of words that are, in fact, always in that top 10. They usually have classical roots, Greek or Latin roots. They usually have a slightly abstract meaning. So I'm talking about words that the current number one word for the year is pragmatic.
Mm.
And we also see words like integrity. I also see conundrum and ubiquitous. Those are words that are almost always up there at the top. This year in the top 10, I also see disposition, insidious, didactic, and hypocrite. So those
sounds are like and a political sounds like a political election year to me.
Yeah, in some sense, but the fact is often these are terms that I do not trace directly to one utterance or one event.
Right.
But that are sort of in the ether. I find that ubiquitous and pragmatic are two, and paradigm, by the way, that's another one that's not quite in the top 10 right now, but it's very often up there. Those are words that I think a lot of people hear or see in writing, or they hear in a speech, and they keep wanting to say to themselves, boy, I need to remind myself, what does that word mean? And I think that triggers a lot of lookups, people just sort of verifying, confirming.
Right. Do words ever get shaved off? Do they ever fall out? Do you ever just cut them out of the dictionary? This word is no longer being used. It's out.
And they sure do. In fact, there's a new video. We have little videos on our website that are about 2 minutes long that explain little tips about grammar, for example, how to use who and whom, for example. But also a lot of dictionary history, publishing history, and also the story of how words are dropped from the dictionary. So you can go to our website and click on videos and see the little video. But what we do is we add about 100 years. We add about 100 words to the collegiate every year. We're talking about a couple dozen of them that we make public. But at the end of the run of a collegiate dictionary, when it's time to revise to the next edition, we're currently in the 11th, the 12th will be the next one. What we do is we revisit every single character of the book. We look at every hyphen, every capital letter, every pronunciation, and that's the moment when we look back in the citations that I just talked to you about, the collection of evidence of the words, and we say, gee, we don't have evidence for this word in the past decade. Let's look at the decade previous, and oh, there's no evidence for that decade either. Maybe we go back 30, 40, 50 years and find that this is a word that perhaps has not been used or not been used very often and has become either more specialized or simply archaic. And those are words that we do drop from the collegiate dictionary. I hasten to add that they, of course, remain in our larger unabridged dictionary.
Okay.
And these are words, I promise you, for the most part, they're not very colorful words. I can think of one that kind of exemplifies this. The unit of currency for the former East Germany was called the Ostmark. The Ostmark, the Ost meaning East in German, and Mark was the unit of currency. Well, we dropped that word in 2003 East Germany had failed. Yeah, East Germany had ceased to exist, in the 90s. And the fact is, if you're curious about vocabulary from a period, that's a really good reason to get a hold of a dictionary from that period. So if you got a dictionary from the 80s, from the Cold War period, from the 80s or from the 70s or 60s or 50s, you would find that word in the dictionary. But it's no longer part of what I like to call the active current American vocabulary, which is truly what the collegiate is meant to represent.
Neat. So you guys added about around 25 words, I think, that I've seen sort of put out. There may be more. And we don't have time to go through them all. We're quickly running out of time. You can check them out on our website at wgbhnews.org. But real quick before I let you go is, do you have a favorite of all of the words that you've added this year?
You know, I do. The one that got the most attention was, of course, F-bomb, yeah, which is the euphemism for the F-word. But I really like the word gastropub because it's sort of, it's a word that encapsulates what it describes. Gastro is sort of highbrow and pub is sort of lowbrow, and you put them together and you get that mixture, which is a great new word for a new kind of restaurant.
Yeah, it's totally true. And do you think that's indicative of our time? Do you think words like when you add a word, are you telling a story about the time?
You know, that's a great point. When we look at these words on an annual basis, it's just a moment in time. It's a moment to recognize something has changed over time. If we didn't take this moment to look at a list like this, we might not notice that the subtle changes of a living language are continual. The only languages that don't change are dead languages.
Very interesting. All right, we're going to leave it there. Peter Sokolowski, lexicographer, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, basically the man behind the dictionary. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And there is Callie Crossley making her way back into the studio. Callie, take us to the weekend.
All righty. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Boston Public Radio. The conversation continues 24 hours a day on our Facebook page. And don't forget, if you tuned in late, you can hear all of our segments online at wgbhnews.org. We'll be back on Monday with a look at new voting laws in Rhode Island and Pennsylvania that some predict will have a big impact on the 2012 presidential race. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great weekend.